Welcome to the Farcast, coming to you every week with insiders and experts to give you insight into the changing economic world. And now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week here in season three of the Farcast. We have a great Farcast for you this morning. Remember that on the Farcast, we think that money is hard to make, that old-fashioned research, hard work, discipline, and dispassion are the keys to successful investing. And above all, emotion is the foe of the long-term investor. So if you're feeling fearful or ebullient, actually, if you're feeling ebullient, you're going to have to explain that one to me. But don't go with your feelings, folks, please, because they will lead you to the wrong conclusion. Been a very interesting few weeks at the beginning of the the end of the third quarter, beginning of the fourth quarter here in 2019. Lots going on. Capitol Hill, impeachment in China, and Brexit and stuff we've been talking about for a while. So we're going back to one of your favorite experts, Kenny Polcari, of course. Kenny Polcari is one of my best friends, colleagues in our business for a whole long time, a CNBC contributor. And if you read Kenny's notes this morning, you would know now that he is actually writing for Seven Figure Publishing. They publish a wealth of information and independent research on the markets. They're dedicated to giving their readers the tools needed to feel financially secure. And Kenny, of course, now is writing for them. And you've got, I know you've got more news coming. Hey, welcome back to the Farcast, KP.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be back, and I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, it's kind of an exciting time for me. A little bit of transition, but transition is good, right? Change is good.
How do you like living in Florida? Now that you're so much older than I am, you know, there are a lot of retirees in Florida, I've noticed. You probably fit in, don't you?
Listen, you can kiss my, I'll leave it there. Because you're just on the other side. You're just on the other side of the state. But actually, there's a lot going on here in Southern Florida, at least on the East Coast. They've done a great job. Palm Beach County, Miami-Dade, Broward County has done a really great job of going up to the Northeast and kind of convincing a lot of these private equity guys and venture capital guys and some hedge funds to, you know, come on down. The weather's great. You can get in and out of the state, no problem. And there's a lot of opportunity out here. So it's actually very different, I think, than the Florida. A lot of people, as you allured to, it is very different from that. It's kind of exciting to be here. Different for me. You know, I love looking out at the ocean and the intercoastal, and I'm enjoying the weather. So it's all good.
That's wonderful. Well, and one of those things I noticed that those hedge fund managers and private equity managers and wealthy people like yourself enjoy down here is that they don't have any state income tax and they don't have any estate tax here in the great state of Florida.
That's certainly a draw. That's
certainly a draw. You get to keep a lot more of what you make. And we're, you know, Kenny, it's an important point because we're seeing the effects of much higher taxes in states like Connecticut and New York. Yeah. And people just kind of look and say, you know, when they pay me that much to leave, I'm out of here.
And they're on, and the truth is, they're only going higher because there is a lot of migration. And Andrew Cuomo and the other governors in the states up there, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, they're all sitting there scratching heads trying to figure out how they're going to make up for it, right? How they're going to continue to support all those social programs. And it was fine when I lived there, supported the social programs. You got a benefit for doing it. But then they took that benefit away. And I think a lot of people sitting there scratching their head going, you know, it doesn't make sense for me anymore. And so now those big Democratic kind of states are trying to figure out how they're going to combat it. And, you know, Cuomo right away decides he's going to raise taxes to make up for it, which only drives people out even faster. So it's a vicious circle up there, and I don't know how they're going to fix it.
Well, you know, and Connecticut is further along in the process. And ladies and gentlemen, this is actually an important discussion as you consider some of the proposals from the upcoming candidates like Elizabeth Warren, who's talking about taxes on everything that you can think about, you know, your wealth, your holdings, your this, your that, everything she can tax, she wants to tax. And it's not just the rich people's yachts, it's the rich people's companies and the investments in those privately held companies that she thinks need to be taken out. And all of those privately held companies own a lot of I mean, employ a whole lot of people and create a whole lot of value to the center of commerce in this country. But the state of Connecticut now is seeing real estate prices really fall because people are leaving. I mean, they're having their economy kind of implode. It seems to be as a result of the higher taxes and the mass exodus that those higher taxes have caused.
Right.
Are you seeing that, Kenny?
Absolutely. Well, listen, I am seeing it, which is why, you know, the housing market in and around certainly the tri-state region, you know, has had trouble really rebounding. Certainly houses below $1 million, there's a lot of activity there. But once you get, you know, plus that $1 million range, and especially that $1 to kind of $2.5 million range has been an area that's been having a lot of difficulty. Taxes are high on those houses. Taxes are going higher. State taxes are high and state tax going higher. And so it's causing a lot of people to reconsider it. Listen, it took me a year and a half to sell my house in New York exactly for that reason. I was in that kind of spot that, you know, caused a lot of consternation for people. And so it was a difficult year and a half to sell it.
Look, Ronald Reagan said you don't get more of something by taxing it. I mean, period, right. End of sentence. You don't get more of something by taxing it. You want more of it, tax less of it. There you go. Kenny, now we've used about half of our segment, but I think that's important because I think it's got to – people have to understand how it is hurting. Real example of higher taxes are hurting and destroying economies in the Northeast, benefiting economies like Florida, like Texas, and a lot of the tax-free zones, those economies are really growing. There's a fine balance, but once you cross that line, you're in trouble. Okay, Kenny, we're looking at a market that looks like it may open 200 points lower on the Dow this morning. We just got a producer price index number that was -0.3%. The expectations were for +0.1%. Tell me what you're seeing in the markets. First, let's talk about that producer price. What do you think that means? Give us
The producer price really goes to speak about the cost of, you know, the production of the product, right? So it's a negative number is less inflationary, right? If that were a positive number, if that were greater than the expectation, people would start to be worried about that building inflation kind of underneath, and is it going to rear its ugly head, and what's the Fed going to do? And that would cause the Feds to reconsider cutting, either maintaining or God forbid, they should raise rates, right? So that negative number this morning certainly puts that to rest. But then it also calls into question, does the Fed really need to even cut rates? Now, you know how I feel about it. I don't think we should have cut rates last month. I don't think we should cut rates this month. I don't think
you and I agree.
December, because it's really pushing on a string. But the fact is, they've said it, they've maintained it, they've told everyone they're going to do it, and so therefore the market expects it. And if they don't do it now, the market's going to throw a temper tantrum. The algos will go into a frenzy and cause a meltdown. And then the Fed and Jay Powell will have to listen to how they caused this massive meltdown in the market.
You said it's like pushing on a string. A rate cut's like pushing on a string. What do you mean?
Well, because at this point, what's it going to do? Rates are already artificially low. I mean, if rates were 6% and you were cutting it to 5%, then you could say, yes, you could see how helpful that is. But when they're 2% and you cut them to 1.75%, what are you really doing? Is there that much benefit that you're getting? And so, you know, you're pushing on a string versus pulling on it. When they were 6% and you cut them to 5%, you know, you're pulling on it, it's better. But at 2%, when you cut them by 25 basis points, what are you really doing? Which has been the argument, right?
Right. Are you really going to borrow money now at 1.5% that you were unwilling to borrow at 1.75%? No,
correct.
That's just stupid. So, and when these companies, corporations get more money like they did in the tax cut, they didn't go out and spend it on CapEx. They didn't build more factories. They didn't create more jobs.
Right.
They did stock buybacks and everything. They've had cheap money for a long damn time. When they get more of it, they're not doing stuff that's growing the economy. And the uncertainty from these China trade talks, along with impeachment and everything else, has corporate America sitting on their wallets.
That's exactly right. What you're going to find is that they're not going to spend big on CapEx when there's all this broader uncertainty, and not so much the political uncertainty, but really the trade uncertainty, right? Because in the end, the political uncertainty, although, you know, it provides entertainment and it's fun to watch, it doesn't really price stocks in the long run, but a trade war and or a slowing economy does. And so that will cause these companies to kind of have a second thought on where their business is. And look, next week, we're going to start with earnings season. So you're going to start to hear what these CFOs and CEOs are saying, not only about the quarter that just ended, but what the future looks like for them and where they feel either comfortable or not.
Right. And, you know, how comfortable can they feel when they feel like the ground under them is shifting? They need a little more certainty, and there's a lot of uncertainty out there. Kenny, we're damn near out of time. Tell us what we should be thinking about markets and what Fred and Ethel should be thinking about their 401k plans as we look at the end of the year in 2020.
So listen, I don't think anybody should be surprised. It feels like the path of least resistance right now is lower. But again, if you're that long-term investor, if you're somebody that's got a well-diversified portfolio, sit tight. Don't, like you said at the very opening, do not make an emotional decision. In fact, use the weakness, if you're a long-term investor, to take cash you've got on the side and continue to add to names that have gotten unnecessarily beaten up, names that you like, names that are in your portfolio, names that you've done your homework on, and ride it out. Do not make an emotional decision.
Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Kenny Polcari, and Kenny has, and I have been doing this for decades now, and I will tell you, you know, this is one of my go-to reads every morning. You read Kenny Polcari. So that's what the pros are doing. Pros are reading Kenny's missives every morning. His morning thoughts, not to mention his morning recipes, are available. They're free of charge. How do we get those from you, Kenny? How do we get on your list for your morning distribution?
You can go to my website, which is kennypolcari.com, and there's a big subscribe button. Just put your email address in there and hit the button. You'll get a confirmation email that that's what you wanted to do. Click on it. You're good to go.
And it's going to start in my inbox. I'm going to see a different address, right?
Well, starting tomorrow, you'll see a different address. It won't be coming from me directly. It'll be coming from my association with Seven Figures Publishing. And it'll come from morning. The in your inbox now, it'll just say Morning Thoughts. It won't have my name to it, but it'll be my note, my voice, my daily missive, my kind of observations of what's going on in the world. So stay tuned because there's more to come.
And they're paying you seven figures now, and our readers get this for free. This is fabulous. Ladies and gentlemen, Kenny Polcari, the voice of Wall Street. When we come back, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, our senior political analyst on what in God's name is going on in Washington. When we come back on the Farcast.
Welcome back to the Farcast, and now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. Terrific to have our friend Kenny Polcari back in segment one, talking about the effects of higher taxes. We really didn't intend to go there, but it's a very important lesson and a very important example about what higher taxes have done in states like Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, driving a lot of their high revenue earners, therefore a lot of their big tax producers, to states like Florida, Texas, New Hampshire, Arizona, some of those tax-preferred states, which are undermining the economies of the home states, like Connecticut, where they're seeing real estate prices really collapse and the economy is struggling. And the solution there is, well, we'll raise taxes some more. Folks, it doesn't work. And as you think about some of these projections and new tax proposals from some of the candidates out there, like Elizabeth Warren, take a look at some of these microeconomic examples in some of the states that have tried it. It does not work. Now, for politics, our senior political analyst on the Farcast is the Right Reverend Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Welcome back to the Farcast, Reverend Dan. Thank you for that blasphemous introduction. Much appreciated.
You're very welcome. Well, I mean, I look at you on that sort of pedestal, if not an altar, really. You have that kind of elevated status, in my opinion. Dan, I just saw a headline that the Trump administration had basically forbidden Bill Sondland, former ambassador to the EU, from testifying to Congress in closed-door hearings this morning. That came after headlines saying that Brexit wasn't going well, and perhaps a call between Theresa May and Boris Johnson this morning sent futures a good deal lower. So we're back to Brexit with a start. And Larry Kudlow says, maybe we could have a reasonable conversation with the Chinese. This is kind of like Groundhog's Day all over again. But tell us which one of those stories strikes you most this morning. But I sure want to hear about all of them from you.
Well, certainly what's striking me most this morning is where you have Kudlow saying that we think we can get to a deal with the Chinese, but we're also getting indicators that the aperture of what would be included in a deal is getting a hell of a lot smaller.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, again, the administration's tried to push for these big deals that they want to get where, look, we have the fundamental issues with technology transfer, the issues with how China props up its economy. And even as Bill Reince said to us last week, the best way to approach the Chinese on this is tell them that this is for their own good. Xi is not going to see that. So now we're just kind of into this soybeans and steel parts purchases and maybe calm down some of the tariff hikes, but none of the big outlines of the deal that the president originally said he was going to get with the Chinese.
So basically, they're saying, we're not going to talk about intellectual property. We're not going to talk about the theft of technology. We're not going to talk about reforming our system at all. But if you want us to buy some more soybeans, we'll do that and give you some face saving at election time. Is that what we're hearing from the Chinese?
We're getting close to that. And even if there is some stuff on intellectual property, they're not going to put the actual reforms into Chinese law like we want to see done. So enforcement becomes a major issue.
Okay. So we're now negotiating a toothless trade deal with the Chinese. And what are your odds of even getting that done, Dan?
I think the odds go down because then you have the administration continuing to talk about delisting Chinese firms from U.S. markets. That hasn't been completely put to bed. Nor has this morning's story saying that the Trump administration is looking to divest U.S. pension funds from Chinese companies and then throw on a ton of companies onto the Department of Commerce Entities list last night for human rights violations against the Uyghurs. And you just see this spiraling out of control again, despite the promising signs that Kudlow had when he was standing in the driveway giving his briefing.
So, you know, just to clarify a couple of those things that Dan just said, the delisting means that we wouldn't let Chinese companies trade on the New York Stock Exchange. The restrictions on pensions, meaning that the U.S. would not allow U.S. pensions to invest in Chinese companies, even if they're not on the U.S. Stock Exchange and had to go overseas to do it. They're just not going to let them. So you're not going to have access to our markets, and we're not going to give you any of our money for any of yours. And the rhetoric kind of continues to increase at a very odd time. Most people don't walk into the negotiation table increasing the angry threats, hoping to find some middle ground. It's a very odd way of negotiating, and this president does it in public. Dan. So your odds of coming up with some sort of Chinese trade agreement here are not particularly high right now. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you think there, but I want to shift to Brexit,
You described it perfectly, and I think we're going to see this too more as we get through impeachment, be it Navarro and Trump on China or whoever spoke to him last about the Kurds. These decisions are going to become more and more impetuous in some ways as the president really
pares down that circle of advisors around him that he trusts?
It seems there are about four now. We'll see how many are left in a few weeks. Certainly, Bill Sondland is not one of the trusted few, it sounds like, out of the White House this morning. Bill Sondland was ambassador to the EU. And why doesn't the State Department and the White House want him to testify in a closed-door session to Congress this morning?
Well, certainly, if you looked at what the testimony given by the Ukraine envoy, Kurt Volker, his testimony and the text messages had Sondland really working to try and further the administration's goals with Ukraine regarding these investigations. And we also have to remember that Sondland was the one who kept telling Volker, as well as Ambassador Taylor, to stop putting these comments in text messages, which, as we all know, when a civil servant deals with the ambassador with the background of business rather than civil service, you can see what the ambassadors were doing when they were trying to get everything in writing. So there's controversy about what he knows. I think the administration also wants to try and maintain a aura of executive privilege around the State Department. And of course, everyone's going to cry hypocrisy because it was Congressman Pompeo who demanded that members of the State Department get hauled before Benghazi hearings back in 2015 and 2016.
All of this adds to the, I guess, gravity of the impeachment process, which is very unsettling to markets here. I don't know that any really believe that that they can come up with two-thirds or 67 votes in the Senate to impeach this president, and certainly not in the next 12 months prior to the election. But I think the odds seem to be changing. Would you agree?
I think the odds seem to be changing, and I again brought it up last week, where I look at the Republicans in the Senate, and I look at people who probably many of them are listeners of this podcast, people who are right of center, believe in markets, believe in free enterprise, and have to wonder what the health of the political party that supports that is going to be if they continue down this path. I got one text message today that said Republican senators need to look at how Trump treated the Kurds as they defend him on Capitol Hill. That's the, you know.
Oh, boy.
How long do you want to tie yourself to this this circus when the polling numbers are starting to get a little, the ice is starting to show some cracks there?
And we really on the Farcast are nonpartisan. We are free market enterprise, unapologetic capitalists, but we consider ourselves moderates anyway, and certainly welcome discourse from both the left and the right so that we can learn more. It's when we talk with each other that I think we can benefit. It's when we talk at each other that I don't think we benefit a lot. Dan, let's go to Brexit, because it's been a few weeks since we got there. Markets seem to fall this morning on that. And tell us what's happening. Boris Johnson, can Boris Johnson get anything done? And are we going to have a new prime minister again in the next couple of months? I mean, it's tough to keep track of these folks.
I think they're going to have an election to get their way out of this, but because his, you know, plan of taking it to the European Union and saying, I want all this plus a pony, did not quite work in Brussels. And therefore, it's up to Parliament now to say, did he actually genuinely try and make a deal with the EU, or was this so pie in the sky he was setting himself up for failure? And to get his ultimate no-deal Brexit down the road, despite Parliament making that illegal. So ultimately, the opposition parties don't want an election without guarantee of a delay, but that October 31st deadline is now the only leverage Prime Minister Johnson has. So everyone's playing poker, but they're both holding, you know, a pair of twos and waiting for the other side to blink.
It's a great way to say it, both holding a pair of deuces and seeing who's going to blink. But I don't think, does anybody believe in that October 31st date? I mean, that's going to get kicked down the road, right?
Oh, it's going to be, unless the European Union finally says, you know what, British, choke on it, take your Brexit, leave. You know what? If the trucks pile up, if the medicine supply decreases, if power's interrupted, that's all on you. And hey, everyone else, look at the price of leaving the European Union. I don't think that's there, but there's the frustration in some of the European countries, some of the European capitals is getting to that point.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we think about that and the way that Dan just described it, when you think about right now, trucks and shipments of goods are able to go in and out of the UK unchecked. As soon as they Brexit, you're going to have custom agents inspecting every one of those trucks. There are going to be fees and charges, and commerce will be reduced. This comes at a time when the European economies are struggling. The British economy is struggling. I guess I have to talk about them separately a bit. But this is going to hurt both sides. Brexit would hurt both the economies of Western Europe and certainly be much more damaging in the UK. And then, you know, when that happens, we are now a part. We live in a world of a global economic fabric that is intertwined, interrelated, and nobody gets off scot-free. So it will affect us. It will, in part, affect the Chinese and Asian markets and South America and so forth. So these are big considerations for investors and an additional headwind as we see economies already facing this big tariff war. I mean, these tariff wars are supposed to be easy. The president told us 20 months ago when this one really began. This doesn't look easy, Dan. And do you see us getting out of this trade war, out of Brexit anytime, anywhere soon?
No, I don't think, because no one's addressing the fundamental populist underpinnings of these trade wars and of movements like Brexit. No one's addressed the economic issues, the uncertainty, and even some of the gaps in education that make it seem like globalism does not work for the average Joe. And therefore, those movements are going to continue to be fueled. And for those who try and marry their free market ideology to populist movements, will continue to do so at their own risk.
You know, average Joe, if you like going to Walmart and buying a flat screen, big flat screen TV for $350, let me tell you something. Globalization is working for you. It's working really well. You're getting to live a better quality of life because we are able to access things inexpensively around the world, and commerce and trade are working. There, we do need to do something with the Chinese. We do have to address this problem. Dan, we've got to go, but tell me, there. I've been hearing that Elizabeth Warren would be tougher on these trade negotiations than President Trump. Truth to that?
I think there's some truth to that, but again, we have to look at the ideology. Some of the trade negotiation stuff she would be tough on would actually include also environmental regulations, labor regulations, things that almost no other country could ultimately subscribe to in a deal, given that it's somewhat out of the scope of traditional trade agreements. So yes, tough on trade, but I don't think that would improve the prospects for making any deals. Given how she would approach them.
And finally, what are you looking at as we go forward? What are we going to be talking about next week on the Farcast? What do you think happens over the balance of this week and the upcoming weekend?
I think now that we have the Chinese protests, the Hong Kong protests continuing and their anniversaries in the background, I think things are going to get pretty bad in Hong Kong over the next week to 10 days. With a crackdown on the protests there. It'll be interesting to see how we respond. And then I think we need to see how Democrats try and keep the momentum going with impeachment inquiry, given that we're moving into the phase where these are a lot of behind closed doors hearings and depositions. So how do you keep this story going with the action moving behind the scenes? The best thing for Democrats appears to be that the president still goes out onto the South Lawn and just yells to microphones about what he's done anyway. But beyond that, the momentum there is a challenge for them.
Syria, also a shock this morning as the president's been yelling. We will have plenty to talk about, I'm sure, again next week. Ladies and gentlemen, our senior political analyst, Dan Mahaffey, from the Center for Study of the Presidency and Congress, is probably the best and clearest voice in Washington, D.C. Dan, thanks for being with us again on the Farcast.
You're too kind, Michael. Always good to be here. Thank you.
The Right Reverend Dan Mahaffey, ladies and gentlemen. When we're going to be right back. Stay with us on the Farcast.
Thank you for listening to the Farcast. I'm Harry Jennings, producer for the show. We also bring you a daily podcast, the Farcast 3-Minute Morning Brief. Each morning the U.S. markets are open, we give you a summary of markets, headlines, commodities, and futures before the opening bell. Available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms, the Farcast 3-Minute Morning Brief. And now, back to Michael and his guests. Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks for being with us again this week. We're having a great Farcast this morning. We talked to Kenny Polcari, the voice, really, of the New York Stock Exchange for so many decades, talking about what's concerning him as we look forward, the volatility, how the Fed may be pushing on a string. We want to see how our next guest feels about that. We talked about the producer price number this morning. It was a negative number, negative 0.3%. We were expecting plus 0.1%. And while that sounds kind of small in terms of those percentages, it means a good deal to economists. We're going to talk to Robert Frick, who is the corporate economist for the Navy Federal Credit Union. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, the Navy Federal Credit Union is the largest credit union in the country, over 8 million members. And Robert Frick was a researcher at Allianz. He was a senior editor at Kiplinger's in Washington and a proud graduate of Penn State University, bachelor's in journalism and MBA in finance. Welcome to the Farcast, Robert.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, we're very glad you're here. So, Robert, as we're looking at a kind of an economy that I'm going to go ahead and tell you that I think it doesn't look awful, but I have my worries. Please tell us what you think. Do you think it looks awful? Give us your assessment of the economy right now.
Well, as usual, Michael, we're pretty much in sync, I'm sorry to say.
It's not fun when we get along.
Yeah.
They like it better when we argue about stuff.
Well, I would just kind of flip it around. I'd say that there's some strong points, but there are a lot of risks. And as long as GDP hangs in around 2%, maybe a little bit less next year, we're going to do fine. But yeah, it seems like there's another shark in the water surrounding our shrinking island, you know, every time we look.
It does. The sharks are circling. When you looked at that producer price number this morning and basically the costs to put goods together actually fell, that's a little bit weird, isn't it? Or was it a surprise to you?
It wasn't a surprise because it could be an outlier. And it also wasn't a surprise because manufacturing, and I understand this is not for manufacturing, but is it soft? Is it strong? We've been waffling along that road for 2 years now. So I don't think it's a warning sign yet, but you know, it's kind of like manufacturing. They said a few months ago, oh, we got one down month, no big deal. Oh, we got another down month, no big deal. Now all of a sudden manufacturing is contracting. Well,
right.
That's the kind of thing I worry about with inflation, but I don't think we're there yet.
So we are seeing a little bit of slowing, but we're not, you know, we're seeing a GDP that continues to grow at 2%. We're seeing a Federal Reserve basically that is not worried about their 2% inflation target. That's the Fed's target, 2% inflation rate. They're not there yet. This number takes them farther away from that. If you were a Fed governor, Robert, what would you be doing? Do you think you've got to cut rates?
I would make a lousy Fed governor right now because I agree, I guess, with your previous guest. Pushing on a string. A quarter point cut here and there, especially with rates as low as they are, is going to make no difference whatsoever. It's a psychological boost. It shows that the Fed is willing to do this or do that. In this case, they're willing to cut rates more. But history shows us that these little tweaks, especially with rates this low, make no difference.
Right. So what would you have Jay Powell do as a response? What would the Fed, what do you think the Fed ought to be doing in this kind of an environment?
Well, as you know, I like what Jay Powell is doing. And I like his take on the matter, which is let's wait and see what the data says. So I think he's doing exactly the right thing. I know that frustrates people who are used to forecasts, and it frustrates the heck out of the markets who, you know, want to know which way rates are going. But especially when we're kind of backed into a corner, we're not backed into a corner yet, we're backed into a room that you really can't cut rates much more. And now you're really pushing the limit that if you really have to cut them, they'll be cutting back to zero. And we know Powell does not want negative rates. So I think, you know, the best he can do is walk this tightrope for now.
Well, you know, Mohammed El Arian, and you may have seen this about a week ago, I thought wrote a great article basically saying, I mean, he basically said that, yes, central banks, not only in the U.S., but around the world are pushing on a string a bit, that they these little cuts aren't going to do all that much at this point. And he was calling for a coordinated effort and policy effort from the fiscal side of the house, from fiscal policy going forward. And, you know, there was some, I thought it was, you know, good news that El Arian was basically saying, you know, quit putting pressure on your central banks because they're not going to make that much difference. But it was a kind of a bad news or concerning news for me that he continues to think that maybe there has to be fiscal stimulus. I've been more in the camp of, geez, I'd like us to wait and see and let these economies sort of try and work themselves forward a bit, because I do see some green shoots. Do you agree with Mohammed El Arian and think that we should have more fiscal stimulus and fiscal policies to get economies around the world moving?
Wasn't this supposed to be Infrastructure Week? things always seem to be getting in the way. Doggone it, once again, agree with you. I see green shoots. Fiscal stimulus, especially when you're in the negative rate situation, it's like you're really emptying your arsenal and there might not be anything left for when you really need it. So just because, you know, Germany hasn't been in recession for a long time and looks like it's going that way, that doesn't mean they're not going to pull themselves out of it. So maybe Germany does some stimulus. Maybe there's some stimulus here and there. But yeah, I read that column, and I am not a, you know, fit to, you know, polish El Arian's shoes, but I have to disagree. A massive global wide stimulus, especially at this point, I don't really think is going to make any difference either.
I think, you know, Robert, what I have been saying for the past couple of years is that we don't have a supply problem in the U.S. or around the world. And basically what I mean is, if we need to make more donuts, we can make more donuts. We can increase production. We have capacity. What we don't have is a line of people outside of our donut shop dying to buy the donuts. If we made more of them, we can't sell more than we're making. So why do we increase productivity? Why aren't the people out there? Because they haven't had any more money. In an economy that's two-thirds the consumer, over 70% the consumer hasn't had any more money to buy the donuts. The American consumer will buy whatever the hell. They'll spend every nickel you give them. They're the most reliable consumers in the world. But just now, when we finally have 3.5% unemployment, which means that 96.5% of the potential workforce have jobs, they are seeing some wage gains. They are increasing their spending. I mean, why not give, you know, these unrepentant spenders a chance to go ahead and spend a little and create a little demand? But or am I being Pollyannish? What do you think, Robert? Tell me why I got this wrong.
Well, darn it. Once again, you're reading Twitter feed.
About something, Frick. Jesus.
I say the same thing over and over again. This is a demand issue. And One of the reasons you say we have a low unemployment rate, and that's absolutely true. On the other hand, we have more and more people living paycheck to paycheck. So there's very little disposable income out there.
Yes.
Many people are just scraping by. So it's a demand problem, which means it's a wages problem, which means people need higher wages. And if people were paid more, it's the, kind of the old Henry Ford thing, pay my workers well, that'll benefit my company. I'll buy more cars. If we pay people more, the demand will go up. And you're right, especially with so many people living paycheck to paycheck, more than 50% of American households, they're going to spend that money. And now we're going to solve the kind of supply demand inequality. So that's, it seems clear to me and it seems clear to you. And yet I see a lot of states resisting minimum wage when minimum wage is shown to have a very minimal effect on jobs, and it boosts economies, it boosts local economies.
You would be an advocate of an increase in the national minimum wage?
No, I think it has to be regional, because what you pay somebody on the outskirts of Manhattan doesn't jive with what you'd pay somebody in a low wage state, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. So
right.
How are those two the same? Now, there could be some sort of index solution, which I've seen, which makes a lot of sense to me. So you index it roughly to the cost of living in those relative areas. Because if you did put what would be an outrageously high minimum wage in some places, that would cause disruption. So the smart way to do it, because economies vary so widely across the country. I mean, imagine a minimum wage in San Francisco, versus a minimum wage in, pick your city in Alabama. It's
right.
A complete mismatch.
Okay. This is going to be an area, finally, we found one where frickin' far disagree. I agree with Robert that a higher wage will absolutely benefit the economy. Higher wages, more money in more hands will absolutely benefit the economy. I would like to see those be driven by the market. And this tight labor supply, I think, is doing that. So I would be against the imposition of it. I think the market will do it, but that's because I'm one of those free market guys.
Well, and, I'm a pretty much a free market guy. But my question to you, Michael, is if the unemployment rate is so low and the workforce is so small, how come wages aren't higher on their own already? Where's the Phillips curve, Michael? Where's the Phillips curve?
I think the Phillips curve is coming. I think that people aren't very patient for it to happen. But, there's a whole lot, I think, Robert, of uncertainty that is undermining what would be otherwise happening in a more normal environment. When corporations aren't spending money, which they aren't, and we're not seeing any CapEx, this is a consumer-driven economy. Because why would corporations invest? One, you're not feeling optimistic at all about what the economic environment globally is going to look like between China, Brexit, what's going on in the EU. There's slowness around the world. We've got political, certainly, instability in Washington. And, I think it'll happen, but they're kind of waiting to see the whites of demand's eyes. I could be Pollyannish, Robert. I hear you. I worry about the forces of putting that minimum wage higher for all the Walmart workers, because ultimately that's going to get passed along and forced along to the consumer again. I'd rather have the consumer drive prices higher by demand than a demand pull. But
well, I take you. I'm not going to strenuously argue, your point. I see it both ways. I just happen to tip more towards a regional or a statewide minimum wage. But as far as waiting for wages to rise, you're familiar with the great existential play, Waiting for Godot, where we're waiting for Philip right now. And Philip curve is not going to come. And I'll tell you why. My reason is globalization, essentially. I've heard it put both ways. We import deflation, yep. We export inflation. Yep. And most of that is wage inflation. Quick story. I fell off my bike, had a concussion, had to get an MRI. No. And the guy reading my film, there was a guy here in Fairfax County, Virginia. And I said, so what did it say, doc? You know, am I going to live? And he says, well, I got to send it for another radiologist to look at. Well, the radiologist was in India. And so wow. he's paying a guy who, or a woman who has gotten a fantastic education, who is incredibly well qualified, one quarter of the rate that he's charging to read, you know, my MRI. And that can be done so quickly now that the pressure, the downward pressure on wages in skilled work especially is incredible.
Yeah.
So
so we're importing that.
Yeah, we're importing deflation. Other people say we're exporting inflation, but I like mine better. I like to be an importer.
I like yours better, but I think the currency, you know, the currency, of course, has a huge effect there. And we've got this very, very right. strong currency. So that's going to keep that going for a while.
Yeah,
okay,
that's true.
We are absolutely out of time. And it's always goes so fast when I get to talk with you, Robert. Give me your sense for the next 12 months. U.S. GDP and how we get through this, and what you would tell Fred and Ethel about their 401k and their investment decisions over the next 3 months and 2020. And then we got to go.
Don't panic, Fred and Ethel. You know, stick in. There's going to be ups and downs. It's going to be very volatile. There may be a correction. Stick with it. If you're close to retirement, go more to cash until you feel comfortable. But I do not see a recession in the next 12 months. But that's one of those sneaky economist, all things being equal predictions. So we can have one of those sharks could come up on land, you know, the dreaded land shark. And then all of a sudden we could tip into recession. But all things being equal, I think we're all right.
Be careful when the doorbell rings. It could be the dreaded right. land shark, ladies and gentlemen. Be careful right. of that. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Robert Frick, corporate economist at Navy Federal Credit Union, the largest credit union in the country, over 8 million members. Thank you so much for being with us again on the Farcast, Robert.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Ladies and gentlemen, that wraps us up for another Farcast this week. Terrific with Kenny Polcari, Dan Mahaffey, and Robert Frick, trying to help us navigate markets, economies, decisions, political, great and small. We hope it's a help to you. We thank you so much for having us into your earbuds and homes and offices and wherever you're able to listen to us on the Farcast. Please share the Farcast on your social media. We're looking for more listeners. Please keep sending us your questions. We will answer them and try and address them for you. I'm in Naples, Florida. Tomorrow I will be on CNBC from noon until 1 o'clock for the halftime report. Please join us then. We'll be back next week with another Farcast. I'm grateful, very grateful to each and every one of you for your great support and loyalty and friendship. From Naples, Florida this week, for the Farcast, I'm Michael Farr.
Thank you for listening to the Farcast. We hope you enjoyed this week's show just as much as we enjoyed making it for you. Please subscribe and share with a friend. Farcast is available for free on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings. Special thanks this week to production engineer Claude Jennings for being on standby. We love hearing from our listeners. Let us know what you like, what questions you have, and what topics you'd like to hear in coming weeks. You can reach us at farcast@farmiller.com. We'd like to remind you that if you think you've heard a recommendation to buy or sell any security here on the Farcast, you haven't. The Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. Before you make any investment decision, we strongly recommend you consult with a financial professional to determine what may be best for your individual needs and your goals. And if we can be of assistance at Farm Miller in Washington, please reach out to us at invest@farmmiller.com. Every week, we bring you experts and insiders to give you a look at the forces that shape our world, the economy, and the investing landscape. Join us next week when special guest Stephanie Link from CNBC and TIAA Nuveen will join Michael. Go beyond the headlines every week with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world.